Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
There's a lot going on, as there is every day, when it comes to COVID-19 and the vaccine. Watching the impact, though, that COVID is having on public health specifically, Dr. Jessica Holzer, assistant professor in health sciences and director of public health at the University of New Haven, with us on the phone from New Haven, Connecticut. Dr. Holzer, nice to have you here. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you here. A lot going on, as there is always in our world, but in particular when it comes to COVID. And I think we continue to assess minute by minute, two steps forward, one step back. Where are we going? How do you see it?
Yeah, so I think even though it might feel like two steps forward, one step back, I think it's really important to keep focused on the fact that we are in a much different place today than we were a year ago when we were facing some of these other return to school questions and return to work questions. We do have a vaccine available for people 12 and older. And that really sets a tone for what's possible. Because we have the vaccine and because we have enough supply now, anyone who can get vaccinated, that creates a really important avenue for an additional layer of protection. And so I think that really has changed where we are, what dance we're dancing now. It's important to recognize that the Delta variant is a different variant than the Alpha variant in terms of how the vaccines are effective. But even though there seems to be some less effectiveness for vaccines, they're still very effective relative to not being vaccinated. And I think that's an important point for us.
But getting more vaccines out there, safe to say, is a key activity that needs to be done to make sure that this virus doesn't essentially mutate to a variant that doesn't react or isn't taken care of by the current plate of vaccines.
Exactly. So the longer that we have unvaccinated populations, and this includes kids, which is why it's still a very high priority for the vaccine distributors and vaccine manufacturers to take into account the kids under the age of 12, but we see that particularly for that 12 to 35 population, we see that's a population that still has substantially lower vaccination rates than populations older than 35, and especially the 66 and above population. And it's important to recognize that they are going to be the students in schools in a lot of cases, both in middle school, high school, and in college, that are going to be presented with opportunities to, in that communal setting, continue to infect one another and to serve as petri dishes for new variants. And so this Delta variant has come about in part because of selection pressure, which is just, which variant can survive in the environment the most, and a variant that's going to be able to avoid vaccination and be able to repopulate in people who are unvaccinated, that's going to be the variant that's going to become dominant, as we've seen with Delta. So avoiding future variants, Lambda and others, is going to essentially depend on us getting as many people vaccinated as possible, getting that vaccine rollout globally, and really trying to reduce the available population who is at risk for developing COVID and therefore would be at risk for COVID replicating into new variants and new variants coming to the fore.
What do you say to parents who come up to you and say, my kids are going back to school, I'm a little nervous, they're too young to get the vaccine, how should we proceed?
Yeah, so I am a parent of a child too young to get the vaccine, mm-hmm. who is herself dealing with those questions, so they are very pertinent, and it's essential to those parents to recognize that the more adults around those children who are vaccinated, the safer those children will be. So my child is unable to get vaccinated. She just turned 4. And the way that I'm protecting her is that every single adult she interacts with is vaccinated. I'm making sure they're vaccinated. I'm making sure that they are still practicing safe practices. So even if they're vaccinated, I'm asking questions with respect to where have they been traveling, what have their activities been, are they possibly someone who has been exposed to someone who had the Delta variant, because we are seeing that there are some breakthrough infections for vaccinated individuals. So those parents, you know, advocate as much as possible for masking. Mm-hmm. Masking your own child is really important, but it's very, very essential that if other children are unmasked, like trying to get that in place. I know this is a source of some real political friction, and so nevertheless, parents have a lot of power to demand masking among their schools and those sorts of places, and keeping those adults vaccinated is really essential.
What are you seeing in communities around the country, some of those less fortunate communities where people are just struggling maybe to, you know, keep a roof over the heads of their family and get food on the table? How are you seeing them in terms of the crisis? I think about New Haven, certainly one of those communities.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, New Haven has some substantial economic variation and, mm-hmm. and populations that have historically been left out of economic mobility and a lot of other things. And that's been a key issue, especially for vaccination. It's been both an information and an access question. What we've seen in New Haven is that we have had door-to-door vaccination campaigns, and I've actually been involved in some of those.
Right.
And those have been really effective at trying to address some of the homebound issues, some of the education issues, and some of the access issues that have presented themselves. I think okay. now it really depends on leaders in communities
right.
and at the state level to keep pressing that out so right. that individuals aren't responsible themselves.
That focus on community is so important throughout this. We've heard that from so many. Jessica, thank you so much. Jessica Holzer, she's assistant professor, program director of public health at University of New Haven.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
One of the discussions that I think surprised some, perhaps even many, over the past year or so, as we often talked about diversity and inclusion, was the lack of just that in Silicon Valley, the epicenter of U.S. innovation. So feeling that deficiency big time are Asian Americans. And that's the subject of a Bloomberg Businessweek story that you can find online and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Let's get more on it from Priya Anand. She is Bloomberg Venture Capital reporter. She joins us right now on the phone in San Francisco and on the remote access in Massachusetts, Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber. Priya, let me bring you in. You did the reporting along with our Ellen Hewitt. Tell us what you set out to find out, or what was it that triggered the question that you knew that there was, okay, I've got to ask and find out more about this story.
That's right. So we've known for a while that Silicon Valley is not great with diversity, and you would assume these companies, you know, companies crop up every day here. A lot of these companies are not that many decades old. You would assume that they weren't saddled with some of the historical issues that other institutions that have been around for maybe hundreds of years might be saddled with. But One key thing that we realized was, you know, in the demographic reports that these companies put out, Alphabet, Google's parent company, Facebook, et cetera, one bright spot always appears to be that Asians account for almost as much of the company as white folks, and sometimes more of the population at a company in the U.S., at least. Facebook, for example, Asian people outnumber their white peers ever so slightly in the U.S. And so we looked at that a little deeper, and we realized, you know, there is a gap as you move up the ranks at tech companies, and the data shows this. There are far fewer Asian folks in leadership compared to their overall representation at the company. So we noticed that gap, and we thought, you know, what is behind that gap? Let's start asking the questions and talking to people.
Yeah, and you know, Jill, I think it is a surprise. You know, we do often cover how tech companies, or we talk with tech company executives, they love to say we've got a lot of diversity and inclusion. And yes, sometimes that is the case, but it's not such a clear picture. It's a lot more complicated.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that is, was really the thrust of the story. And what Priya did, I think remarkably well, is like, there's the data side of the story, but then there's the human one. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to actually like take a moment, like these are people who haven't often spoken on the record about sort of the environment, that the work environment that they're in. And there were several themes that stuck out, I think, in the reporting. And Priya, why don't you just talk to us about what some of those were and what people felt?
Yeah, and like Joel said, so one of the things that is most frustrating for Asians in the tech industry is that the racism against them is barely acknowledged. There's this idea, I spoke with someone yesterday who said, thank you for writing this story, because there's been this idea that we shouldn't talk about this because at least we're well represented at these companies. But there are a lot of challenges that come along the way as you're progressing at a tech company. We spoke with folks who are fairly young, in their 20s. As an intern, a woman who moved to San Francisco for an internternship was told, you know, white men here will love to date you. And so for women in the tech industry, there's this double whammy, right, of receiving the gendered feedback and also this sort of feedback that fetishizes Asian women. The same woman has been told by a manager or by a colleague that, you know, you only have succeeded here because someone in leadership has an Asian fetish. And this is someone in their 20s. And this person, you know, has also been told that they lack executive presence, which for someone in their 20s, you know, is this vague kind of coded feedback on what does that even mean? You've never managed anyone in the first place. And when you combine all those things together, it's quite a discouraging outlook. And then when folks reach middle management stage, this vague feedback continues, right, related to executive presence. And also people are often told, you know, you don't fit the profile of what we're looking for in this role. And they look at their credentials. They look at their successes that they've had in their career. They look at their peers. And sometimes the only difference is they're an Asian American compared to a lot of their white peers. Right. And they're left wondering whether this vague feedback had something to do with their performance or their credentials, or is it about their identity?
So, you know, one of the other elements that I thought was so significant about the story was that we're not just talking about names that you know and the characters that you talk to. I mean, it feels more like rank and file that you guys were able to, that you and Ellen were able to speak with. But there is one person that I think is more identifiable than others, which is Ellen Powell. And, you know, that she became famous for the case that she lost in 2015. But it also, you know, it speaks to sort of what she was able to accomplish and her legacy a little bit. So what did you learn from talking with Ellen Powell?
Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to chat with Ellen Powell about in particular was when she was interim CEO of Reddit. Firstly, why was it interim, right? Did the board coming in decide that she wouldn't be staying on forever, and why was that? And she says she looks back and wonders the same thing, why she had that tacked onto her title, and she let it go at the time. But one of the things that struck me most is looking back on her career, while she was running Reddit, there were all these racist memes that users would post, calling her Chairman Mao, or Chairman Pao, after, you know, Mao-style memes. And that just seemed really striking, right, to rebel against the changes she was making with not just any kind of meme, but these, frankly, very racist memes, calling her Chairman Pao. So that was something that I think, if that happened now, perhaps we'd look at even more than it was covered in the past. And Ellen Powell is such an example for folks, right, of someone who rose and who tried to push back against the lack of diversity in the tech industry by suing Kleiner Perkins for gender discrimination. And she also feels, looking back, that a lot of what she experienced was race-related as well. But as a legal strategy at the time, her lawyers advised her to just go with doings for gender.
There's so much, so much in this story, including how there are different experiences for different Asian Americans. So I highly recommend that everyone check it out. I'll put it out on Twitter. Priya, thank you so much for bringing it to us. Priya Anand, she's venture capital reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from San Francisco, written with our own Ellen Hewitt. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, on the remote access from Massachusetts.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Speaking of updates, we're going to get one from the Walt Disney Company. They report their latest quarterly earnings after the close tomorrow. Ahead of that, a story that is among our most read on the Bloomberg today. It's about the company's Star Wars experience, a new galactic-themed hotel with what some might say is an astronomic price tag. Here to fill us in and what it may be portends, if you will, when it comes to experiences, especially among the wealthy, is Connor Sen. He is Bloomberg opinion columnist, founder of Peachtree Creek Investments. He joins us on the phone from Atlanta. Connor, good to have you here. I love this story. Caught my attention this morning when I was reading in. So first of all, tell us what Disney is up to.
Well, I think people look at the price tag and they think about what a theme park costs. Maybe Disney World is $125 a day, hotels a few hundred dollars. And then they see a two-day experience for two adults at $5,000, and they're thinking, what's going on here? But I think they've sort of seen that there's an appetite for this higher-end luxury consumption that isn't being met by the marketplace, and they intend to tap into it.
Right, because it sounds a little like, wait, what? It's going to be a small audience. But remember when we thought there was only going to be a small audience maybe for these expensive Apple iPhones, and yet they've created a lot of wealth for that company, and a lot of people have snapped them up. What do you think is kind of the more significant sign or what we should read into kind of what Star Wars is up to? Not Star Wars, what Disney is up to?
Well, I think we know that household net worth, especially at the top, has increased significantly over the past 10 or 15 years, and particularly over the past 12 to 18 months. Home prices are up a lot. Stock portfolios are up a lot. If you work from home, you've probably done just fine over the past year. And so coming out of this pandemic, and say next year after we get through all these variants, there's going to be a lot of untapped appetite for sort of luxury consumption. And there really aren't a lot of great ways to do that, at least nothing that's sort of newish. And so Disney says, here's something new, something exclusive, and they think it's going to be a hit.
Do you really believe that there's not a lot of ways for those who are really wealthy to kind of spend their money? Because you know the argument that's out there, though, that right. When it comes to consumer spending, it's not the ultra wealthy that really spend all their money. Is it really from a lack of things to spend it on?
I mean, I think you could look at things like cryptocurrencies and maybe meme trading and some of this stuff as people have money to burn and they're willing to gamble on sort of crazy things just because there's so much cash flowing around or collectibles like baseball cards and what have you. And so I think when it comes to experiential stuff, a lot of what's out there was out there 10 or 15 years ago, and there's nothing that's quite new and novel.
Well, and you take us back to I think it was the early to mid-1990s, right, when we kind of saw a similar thing happened in terms of more expensive experiences being offered up. Tell us about that.
Right. So sort of between 1990 and 1995, call it, you had sort of the modern Las Vegas popped up with casinos like the Mirage and MGM Grand. You had sports stadiums that really sort of upscaled and went luxury with luxury suites and personal seat licenses. Even at movie theaters, you had the invention of the Megaplex and these stadium seatings and reclining chairs and what have you. And we haven't had a whole lot of that over the past decade or so. And so people have gotten wealthier. There's an appetite for something new and novel. And so you create a price point and experience that people want.
So what does this mean then, kind of bigger, broader? You know, you're an investor, watch the markets. I think about our audience who are hearing this. And so what does this mean? Do you think potentially we'll see more costlier experiences being created out there for because the wealthy are ready to spend some money if there's options out there? Like, how do you see it playing out? What's the significance, especially when I think about the Bloomberg audience?
Yeah, I think if you're a corporation and you see the Star Wars hotel be a big hit at, you know, $5,000 for a couple nights, you're thinking, what can I offer that's a $5,000 experience that people are willing to pay? And so whether that's Universal Studios, maybe it's more Disney parks, maybe it's cruise ships, we can sort of have even more luxurious events. I think there's going to be a real land grab to sort of create your own $5,000 experience and hope people will pay for it.
What does it mean in terms of economic momentum, too? Because I always think about economic cycles often have, you know, several legs, right? And several things that kind of either keep it going or ultimately make it stop or slow down. Could this potentially provide another leg to the economic momentum that we're certainly seeing at this point?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you have maybe new casinos in Las Vegas get built that are several billion dollars of construction and jobs, working class jobs, sort of also people working at these resorts. And then, you know, you see how the wealthy spending their money, they're creating jobs for the working class to serve them. It also helps companies deal with the rising costs they're dealing with right now. There's sort of a lot of ways that you could sort of power a new cycle that's not as dependent on maybe tech and what we've seen over the past decade.
I did think that was really interesting in your column when you talked about, you know, presumably Disney will be able to pay more than $15 an hour to staff at its Star Wars venue if it needs to. So when things cost so much, that gives a company that's offering it potentially more room to either pay its workers or spend on investments.
Right. One part of the pricing power story is just being able to offer new products and services at higher price points that people are willing to spend more on. It doesn't necessarily mean just charging more for your existing stuff.
All right. So are you going to take this Galactic Star Cruiser trip?
I'm going to see what the reviews are like. That's pretty steep for us, but we'll see.
All right. Yeah. And we thought going up into space with one of the billionaires was expensive. And it is. But this is also a pretty high price point. A really fascinating column, Connor. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Connor Sen, he's Bloomberg Opinion columnist, the founder of Peachtree Creek Investments, joining us on the phone from Atlanta. A reminder that Disney will be reporting their earnings after the close tomorrow. And I'm just bringing up the stock right now in terms of, it's just down about 1.5% so far here in 2021.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. We have just about 10 and a half minutes left in today's trading session, and we are off our best levels, just barely, on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Same story for the S&P 500. Records on both of those we've seen in today's trading session. NASDAQ just down a hair and off its worst levels of the day. So let's get to it with Vinny Catalano. He is Chief Market Strategist at Stuyvesant Capital Management with us once again on the phone in New Jersey. Vinny, nice to have you here. Feels like it's a little bit of the dog days of summer. How do you see the trade right now?
I see the trade as continuing what it's been, you know, for the better part of the last year. You know, what we have is we have a lot of money, a lot of easy in and easy out to the markets, the publicly traded markets, that is. And so, you know, it had been referred to the stock market in situations like this as being a casino, being in Never Never Land. I say it's in whatever land.
Whatever land.
Whatever land. Whatever number sounds good to you, you know, it's just that's the environment we're in.
So,
Lots of money.
So when you say whatever land, does that mean you think there's some irresponsible trading going on and overvaluation that we're seeing in various? Yeah, I'm going to say yes.
Overvaluation. Yeah, that's yes. There is a by every measure of evaluation. Certainly in times of yore, when the stock market at least made a reference to what the private equity markets and the fixed income markets make a reference to all the time, and that is the present value of the future cash flows. And what do we have now? We have rationalizations for any valuation level that sounds good. We have meme stocks that basically are, I don't know what, but there's no reference to fundamentals that are there. And so this is going to go on until it stops going on. That's the environment we're in.
But don't you also feel it is a market? I mean, if you like take a look at something like AMC, which went above 60, we're now back at 31. Maybe that still makes no sense considering it was a low of, what, $5.51 back in February of this year. But nonetheless, it does seem like, you know, putting meme stocks aside, it feels like individual investors are having some fun out there. But you feel that way for all sectors of the market, even
no.
Some of those? Okay.
Yeah, not all sectors of the market, and certainly not all sectors of the investable market, meaning into the private market area. One of the things that investors might consider, if they have the ability to do it, is to take a look at the private markets, because the private markets offer better value, they're more rooted in fundamentals, and the opportunity to go public into what is clearly an inflated stock market via SPACs or other methods is there. So if you want to find value, that's kind of where the value would be. Now, in the publicly traded space, it's a heck of a lot harder. I think what investors would do, that makes the most sense, besides all of the fundamental things that they should do, like take a look at their portfolios, make sure that everything is aligned with their wants and needs, their risk tolerances, etc. So when you take all of those things into consideration, that's good. That's all good basic stuff. I guess the way to look at it is to look at thematic issues. Mm-hmm. To see what trends and themes that look like they're going to be there for a longer period of time, so that this way, if you're invested in an area and that area doesn't do, if it hits a speed bump along the way, then, you know, you're in something that you want to be in. But going into issues and areas because everybody else is doing it, well, yeah, that can work until it stops working.
So
at that point, then you're stuck with something that you really don't want to own.
So when you say private markets, are you talking about private equity specifically, or what else are you talking about?
Well, private equity or anything that can be converted into mm-hmm. publicly traded equities, because there the valuation gap, if you look at the statistics over the last 10, 15 years, and you look at P.E. ratios of comparables of publicly traded versus privately held issues, you'll see that the privately held issues remained a pretty constant level in terms of valuation, P.E. ratios. And so they stayed closer to whatever the interest rate changes might be.
Right.
Whereas in the publicly traded issues, they were all over the lot, you know, significantly above, significantly below. And that's mainly because of liquidity. You can get in, you can get out, and why not? You know, it sounds like fun. In fact, what I would like to do is for you and I to create an offering to Quentin Tarantino, to offer him that we will put together a program for him to do a follow-up to his Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. We'll call it Once Upon a Time on Wall Street.
Well, it feels
because
like
Once Upon a Time on Wall Street, the stock market made a reference to value. Today, it's like, whatever.
Do you feel like it's more out of whack than it was during the tech bubble or during the run-up in real estate and real estate-related financial instruments?
If it walks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, then most likely it is a duck. Yeah, there are
different types of ducks, though.
Well, there's a lot of similarities in that regard, but so, you know something?
What?
John Maynard Keynes said it. Hey, markets can remain irrational longer than you can remain solvent.
You know what's interesting? And do you like SPACs?
Do I like SPACs?
Yeah.
I like private issues that have the opportunity to go through SPACs, yeah.
Okay.
I think that's, you know, that's good. SPACs look interesting, but, you know, there's so many of them out there, and, you know, I'd rather do our movie idea with Tarantino.
I can tell. Well, the reason I bring up SPACs is if I look at the SPAC index or one of the SPAC indexes, it's at about 26%. So what we seem to keep finding is that people make money very early on, but the longer it goes on, that's not the case. So, again, for an investor, if you're lucky enough to be in and out, great. And if you have access early enough, that's great. But that might not be the case for most investors out there.
That is correct. If you qualify for private investments, okay, and you've had on your program in the past Lawrence Calcano from iCapital Network, and it's not a plug for them, but just that's an area to take a look at if you qualify to see what iCapital Network has to offer, to see if there isn't something there in the private space that might make sense for you.
Do you get nervous, though? And I'm taking a look at some of the work that Peter Atwater is doing over at William & Mary, just sending me a note, but, you know, concerned about some of the money sloshing around, though, when it comes to private equity. There's a lot of money chasing a lot of stuff that needs to be put to work. Otherwise, the private equity firms have to give it back. You know, so, I mean, you got to be careful there, too.
Absolutely. You really have to do your homework in the private space, okay? Mainly because once you go in, you're not getting out. You're going to be not getting out anytime soon. That's the polar opposite of what goes on in the stock market. I get in now, I get out later. Whereas with the private market, get out later, meaning very, very quickly. Whereas in the private market, you get in and then you're there, and
right.
You have to do the due diligence. You've got to do the research, and that's not an easy thing to do. But that's where the better value happens to be, at least you know, the way the way it looks compared to the public markets.
All right, we got to run. Hey, Vinny, good to check in with you. Hope you and your family are well. Vinny Catalano, he's chief market strategist at Stuyvesant Capital Management, joining us on the phone in New Jersey. And folks, we just have a few minutes left in today's trading session.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.